Back with you on Connecticut Today for Thursday, January the 28th. We heard the latest from Governor Ned Lamont regarding the rollout of vaccines during the ongoing coronavirus pandemic here in the state. Republican State Rep. Laura Devlin from Fairfield County checked in. She took part in a public hearing a few days prior to the show regarding the possible installation of a pilot program in the state for unmanned robotic speed cameras around school zones and also some highway construction sites. And I also took a few moments during the show to mark 35 years since the tragic deaths of the crew of the Space Shuttle Challenger. Today, back in 1985, the explosion of the Space Shuttle Challenger, the Challenger disaster. You know, and we recently got done talking about this with the Capitol riot. There are probably four or five things in history, really now, in the U.S., that are in the category of where were you when you heard about blank? And it's a select few things. It really is. It's a select few things. The Kennedy assassination, and before that, Pearl Harbor. So Pearl Harbor is one. The Kennedy assassination, two. 9/11, three. I would put I would lean toward putting the Capitol riot from 3 weeks ago in as, you know, as one of them, at the fourth one in there, because it was just a stark image that is really going to stick with people. And also, in that category, where were you when you saw the image or heard of the Challenger disaster? I mean, it really... On live television, we saw people, we saw and we were reminded, and we're even reminded of it today, even with NASA still there and all these private space companies, you know, SpaceX, Blue Origin, all these people, Virgin Galactic, we are still reminded of how gosh darn dangerous space travel is. And I remember I was working at a radio station, my first, I think it was my second job. I was vacillating between a couple of stations, you know, working two or three gigs, one full-time, one part-time. And I walked into what was our newsroom, and I saw two or three people crowded around the small TV set I had there. And I said, what's going on? And I just saw those white contrails in the air. And, you know, I think one of our staffers had tears running down her cheek. And that was, wow. So, yeah, you would put the Challenger disaster up there with, you know, what happened last week and Pearl Harbor and 9/11 and the JFK assassination. It was just that image, and it was on live television. And the build up to that, because of, you know, the teacher in space, Krista McAuliffe, and, you know, I think I've told you over the years doing these shows here and other places that I'm a real space runt. I mean, to this day, I still gobble everything I can up about the U.S. space program. I'm very proud of it. It galls me that we stopped going to the moon 30-something years ago. It's ridiculous. Think of where we would be today if we just kept doing it and didn't listen to the naysayers, but that's another topic for another show. You know, NASA, part of NASA, what NASA had to do was stay on a schedule because it's real expensive to do space. You know, there were no SpaceXs back then, or Virgin Galactic, or ULA, United Launch Alliance now, or Blue Origins and those people. It didn't exist back then. And late 60s, early 70s, you had people saying, hey, why are we spending all this money on space when there are people starving? Well, the space program is the greatest research and development program ever, ever, ever. For every dollar that's gone to the space program, the returns on it have been immense for the entire world. Just stuff we use every day now. But anyway, so they pushed Krista McAuliffe, as you remember, to be this teacher in space. It was a PR, let's call it for what it was. It was a PR stunt. And it was, but she trained, she was ready to go. And if you watch any of the special programs on it, and I know there's that one on Netflix, I've heard okay reviews of it. I prefer to point people to one that I posted on my Facebook page. It was one done by, I think, the Discovery Channel and the History Channel several years ago. that gets into more of the science of why that launch was done when it just shouldn't have been done. I mean, listen, when NASA screws up, and they have in the past, with the Space Shuttle Challenger and the Columbia, let's not forget the Columbia, too, which died because, you know, there was a hole in the wing created by some spray-on insulation that a lot of people say didn't need to be there. It was ridiculous. There was no need for it. And the Apollo 1 fire. When NASA screws up, it's deadly. But what happens is you also remember and find out, as we did with the Challenger and the Columbia and the Apollo 1 mission, that there were always people screaming in the background going, no, 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 don't do this, don't launch this. And there were scientists screaming about not launching in the cold weather with the Challenger. There were scientists not screaming about not putting that stupid insulation on the outside of the Columbia, that it was going to hit something and break something. And there were scientists and people screaming not to lock up the Apollo 1 crew in that test capsule with pure oxygen at high pressure, with a hatch they couldn't open, and with exposed bare wiring. You know, that's high school physics 101. So if you have any thoughts about that or anything else, but that was tough. That was watching astronauts die. And the tough part about that is in the years that have followed with all the stuff that's leaked out about this now, and engineers, as they get older, right before they die off, they're willing to speak now on the record. You know, they couldn't when their careers were still tied up with NASA and all the subcontractors. It's pretty much accepted now that the crew compartment of the Space Shuttle Challenger did survive. Remember, the lower part of the booster blew up, and the because of the failure of that O-ring and the fuel tanks. You can see the front part of that cabin where the crew was clustered and strapped in. It was pretty much intact. So we've come to find out over the years that they were all probably in some degree of consciousness as the front of that orbiter tragically plowed into the ocean at, you know, 300 to 400 miles an hour, and that certainly ended their lives. So we remember the Challenger crew today, along with the Columbia crew and the three astronauts, Ed White, Gus Grissom, and Roger Chaffee on Apollo 1 today.
Relatively speaking, the lowest, as low as it's been in the last few months. Fatalities exceeded 7,000 now, another 44. But I think what it's important in terms of the positivity in the trend lines is our 7-day average is down. It's down to about 4.4%. We got a lot of work to do, but the trend is still, positive on that front. And we have good capacity in our hospitals. And that leads us to what we're trying to do in terms of vaccinations. This continues to show you that Connecticut continues to be a leader in getting people vaccinated. Now we got to make sure the right mix of people are vaccinated. 300,000 first doses, 364,000 in total. 35% of the folks 75 and above are vaccinated. Let me just take a short pause on that. I mean, given some of the good news you see in our trend lines, there's more urgency or some pressure, I think, to consider reopening. And we're going to give you some clear guidance on that early next week. As you maybe know, some of our neighbors, Rhode Island and Massachusetts, are lifting the curfew on their restaurants. We have a curfew that goes till 10 o'clock. We have higher occupancy, so it's not apples to apples, but it's worth looking at. And I got to look at the houses of worship, and fundamentally, ending the numerical cap on the houses of worship. There's been some legal cases around the country. You probably know there's some folks outspoken who think it's now's the time to do that. And I think we're going to do that. Look, I'll be blunt. We're going to have all the folks 75 and above vaccinated or want to get vaccinated, at least with their first dose, within a couple of weeks. Moving quickly into the 65 and above, much safer to do to go to church once you've been vaccinated, go to a house of worship once you've been vaccinated. So err on the side of caution, but these are some changes we're going to make given the nature of the changes you've seen, and we'll be very clear on that first thing next week. Also, good news, met with Jeff Zients. He's the new COVID coordinator, 16% increase in first doses. I think that's going to take us from 46 to 54,000. That's good. Start to use those second doses so we get more people vaccinated faster. And that's never been more important. And those additional doses we're getting right now are going to be focused on those 75 and above in the underserved communities. And let me talk about that for a second. This is a Josh Jabal chart. This is a little test. I'm going to let you read it the same time I am. But what it says is, look, in terms of those socially vulnerable communities, those communities where folks, maybe they're living in multi-generational housing, densest communities, black and brown folks, those that can't telecommute, going to work every day, those most at risk that impacts their health, their personal health, as well as the community health, because you've seen the possibilities of flare-up, we've only 23.5% of them have gotten their first dose. Compared to overall the broader population, it's 33.6, it's actually over 35% now. So what I'm trying to say is, for the greater good of the public health, as well as those particular communities, we're making a special effort to make sure that high-need group, that 23.5%, who are right now underserved in terms of vaccinations, just like we had to do with testing a few months ago, making a special effort in terms of vaccinations. And that's what I'll talk about here. How are we doing that? First and foremost, okay, I got it. I don't like vans. I don't have email. I'm not very good on the internet. So we've expanded the telephone, 877-918-2224. I say that with trepidation because everybody may call. But I understand how important that is, especially for those who are older, like myself, who sometimes I even find Amazon confusing sometimes. So we're making this as easy as we possibly can for you. We have 80 additional people who are taking the calls. Many of them were doing track and trace before, but as our infection numbers go down, little less to track and trace, they're going to be answering your phones. Wait time's down to 3 minutes. I said, show me. So I called that number, 918-2224. They direct me. I said I wanted to go to Rentschler Field. And a wonderful woman named Ellen called up in no time at all. And she'd been doing track and trace. It was her fifth call. I told her I'm calling everybody to thank them for what they're doing. We're doing everything we can. Beyond Rentschler Field, we're going to be booking 6 additional sites statewide. You'll be able to access them off of that same phone number. I think that's on Monday. We're rolling out our retail outlets because as we begin to finish up our nursing homes, obviously in our hospitals, we're going to make the vaccine more readily available, A, at those mass distribution facilities and centers, and our retail locations. I see 14 are already open at Walgreens and CVS. We provided a lot of guidance to our senior centers, helping people with enrollment, calling out to people, letting those 75 and above know they are eligible. Can we help you make an appointment? Working with our community partners. And also focusing on the congregate facilities. I think we mentioned earlier this week, we're the first ones, I think, in the country just about to do homeless shelters. Again, those folks who are underserved, most likely at risk to the community. Angel pointed out we're rolling out the Department of Corrections. I think that's starting first thing next week, starting with the corrections officers and inmates over the age of 75. And we have, very many senior housing mobile clinics. So just like we did with testing a few months ago, bringing the vaccine to you and making it easier for you to get vaccinated and what that means. So this, I just love this quote, to tell you the truth. This is why this is here. We're reaching out to vulnerable seniors. You see what that means. But The Hill is a community in Greater New Haven that feels they've been left behind for some time. And as Alderman Ron Hurt said, the Hill has been the last in everything. But now we're finally the first because we brought the mobile testing van there and we brought the mobile vaccination there. And there are people getting vaccinated, making it easier for you to keep yourself safe and your community safe. What are the results of all this, all these vaccinations? What does it mean? I think we've said before that one of the reasons we wanted to prioritize the nursing homes was they're the ones that, most likely to suffer severe complications and most likely to go have to go into the hospital. And we're doing everything we can to preserve capacity in the hospitals. So we are the first state in the country to get everybody their first vaccination or first or second, in the nursing homes. That's important. As you can see, the number of residents who are testing positive is down by 2/3 in about 3 weeks. And that will be continue to be reflected in terms of hospitalizations and, pray to God, reflected also in terms of fatalities. Safe at School, I was sort of intrigued to see the CDC, Center for Disease Control, rolled out and reflected what we've been saying for quite some time, that schools are not a driver of transmission. You're less likely to pick up the virus at school in the classroom where you're wearing a mask than you are in the greater population. And I think that's good news is being reflected in the confidence of our parents and teachers. I think we're well over 50% of our schools now have full-time in-person learning. Obviously, if a child or a parent doesn't feel comfortable with their kid going to that school, they can learn from home, but at least they have full-time in-person available. And almost all the rest have a hybrid as an alternative. Very few that are all virtual at this point. You know, with that, I made a big deal about how we're working hard to go to the populations that are toughest to reach, how important that is for their health, how important that is for public health. And I'd like to introduce to you Kurt Barwis. He runs Bristol Hospital. Bristol has really taken the lead in terms of outreach to the greater community, especially a black and brown community. And he's got some pretty good help and a great guy named Eric Clemens, who maybe you've seen as the voice of sports here in the state of Connecticut, and now also doing outreach on behalf and making sure the communities that didn't always feel confident and comfortable getting the vaccine are doing so. Over to you, Kurt.
Unmute, sorry. Governor, thank you so much for that introduction and a personal thank you and for your leadership, your team, Department of Public Health. You have all been working endlessly around the clock since this thing started, and I just can't tell you how much I appreciate that. So we do have this really unique and special relationship with the local branch of the NAACP. Started some time ago. Lexi Magnum was the local president. He came onto our board of directors almost 6 years ago and has really helped us develop this unique relationship where we do a lot of outreach. We do local community sessions where we bring healthcare providers to talk about their issues in the local churches and things like that. And just back in December, early December, Eric Clemens was announced as the new incoming president of the local branch. And so Lexi coordinated a meeting between Eric, myself, and him. And we started to talk through some of the issues with reaching this really vulnerable community and how we might do that. And what really shocked me was both Lexi, almost exactly at the same time as Eric, said, there's just so much fear. There's just so much concern about, is it safe? Is it okay? And how are we going to convince, the members of our organization that it's okay to do this? So we quickly started to talk about how we were going to do that. And we actually came up with the idea of doing a virtual town hall meeting with physicians and medical staff, which was very well attended. There was almost 100 people that attended that. And the questions they asked were incredible. And I'm going to turn this over to Eric to really take it from there. But again, thank you, Governor, and your team for just an incredible job leading this state through this pandemic. Eric.
Thanks, Kurt. Over to you, Eric. Kurt.
Okay, Governor Kurt, can you guys see and hear me loud and clear?
We sure can.
All right,
nice
great.
Backdrop.
Well, you would mention that, Governor. Well, I'm actually in California visiting my daughter and my first grandbaby, and this is my daughter's little studio, so it's all glammed up in pink and stuff. It wouldn't be my first choice, but I have to take what I get when I'm visiting, right? You know, Kurt talked about it, the partnership between Bristol Health and the NAACP. It ensures a trust between the community and organizations like Bristol Health and, of course, that community that they serve. Now, in terms of voting drives, we've collaborated on that just last fall. We had a voter registration event. More than 100 Bristol residents registered to vote in that record-breaking, in terms of turnout, election that we just completed this past November. Kurt mentioned how myself and my colleagues really heard all kinds of concerns, some of them based in rumor and misinformation, others based in some history about how African Americans have been treated in the past by the medical community. And many were concerned about the COVID vaccine. So we scheduled a forum with experts who presented evidence on the benefits of the vaccine and really helped answer a bunch of questions, a flood of questions that came in, general questions that I had never thought of, but really did a great job in, I think, allaying a lot of fears. More than 100 people attended that presentation, and many shared the link to that presentation. That link is right on the front of the Bristol Health website. Right now, you can find that link, and I recommend anybody check it out and look at it and get some answers to your own questions you may have. BristolHealth.org has that link, and again, every question you could pretty much think of was asked of those medical experts and answered to the best of their ability. And it certainly, I passed along some of the information to my family, and it really did a world of good. Governor?
Thank you very much. Any questions?
NBC Connecticut.
Good afternoon, Governor. First of all, now that all the nursing homes have received vaccinations, I'm wondering if you think it's time to withdraw the legal immunity that you gave them at the beginning of the pandemic, which prevented anyone with a family member who died or was injured in a nursing home from suing.
Yeah, Kristen, that's one of the things we have under consideration. Give me a little time on that, if you would.
Okay, and we've also heard reports of at least one Connecticut superintendent telling parents that the Department of Public Health has informed school districts to be prepared for the possibility of full remote learning in March due to the potential of a more infectious variant of the virus becoming prevalent in Connecticut. Can you give parents and even employers listening at home a little more insight into what to possibly expect?
Yes, there are several super infectious variants of COVID-19, the UK, which we've had probably 8, I think, total diagnoses here, out of, tens of thousands. There's just today, we found the South African variant in South Carolina, I think it was. Right now, I think our vaccines are going to be able to stay ahead of whatever risk there is there. Maybe it's 0.1% of our population is infected with there. It's growing. We don't know how fast it's growing. You know, Scott Gottlieb warns me that in some parts of the country, it's not at 0.1%, it's at 5% or 6%. And there, those are places where vaccines may not be able to stay ahead or have a tougher time. I'm fairly confident that if we continue our flow of vaccines, they continue to up the ante, we're going to be having school in March.
Okay, and then lastly, on Monday, you had said about 1-2% of the vaccines distributed so far might have gone to people who weren't actually eligible at this time. So that would be about several thousand people at least. Can you provide a more exact number and tell us if any safeguards have been put in place to prevent that from happening again?
I'll pass this to Josh, but 1 or 2%, I think, is a high number. I think the number of folks that have... maybe the vaccines should not have gone to them preliminarily. Most of that, I think, was inadvertent. I don't see a lot of games being played. We are following that because there's a fundamental sense of fairness. And people have got to realize we're doing everything we can to make sure the distribution of this vaccine is be done on a fair basis as possible, with an emphasis upon public health. Josh, do you have anything to add on that?
I think that's right, Governor. I think the numbers are smaller than that in terms of people who may have inadvertently been vaccinated out of order. And as the governor said, the cases we've seen, we think, are honest mistakes. But it's worth people remembering that when they sign up for a vaccine, you do have to do a test under penalty of perjury that you are eligible in that phase. So that's a good reminder. And our DPH licensing team is doing some spot checks, looking at rosters of people who have been vaccinated. So there are eyes on this. But so far, as the governor said, we have an enormous amount of trust and confidence in our providers, both our hospitals, our federally qualified health centers, our local health departments, that they're vaccinating in line with the governor's guidance, and trust in the people of Connecticut, too, that they understand the prioritization, why it's so important to get our senior citizens vaccinated, given the significant challenges with COVID-19.
Okay, thanks.
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Yes, Governor, you know, since the Biden administration announced that more doses will be shipped, do we know how many roughly Connecticut might see?
We have better visibility than we had a month ago. The numbers are going up. I was talking to my co-chairman, Bill Lee, about just this. We're reaching out to Pfizer. We're reaching out to Moderna. Reaching out to Jeff Zients, seeing if we can get a better handle on how fast we're going to be able to ramp up production of the vaccine and how that will be distributed, so the governors across the country can get not a 1 or 2 week window, but a 5 or 6 week window, allow us to prepare accordingly.
Something that was discussed earlier this week at the Capitol, virtually because of the COVID limits on hearings and all that, that you may be interested to find out about. Connecticut could soon have a new way to nab speeders. A proposal for automated speed cameras that was debated or talked about Tuesday afternoon. It was a virtual public hearing among those taking part. Republican State Rep Laura Devlin, who joins us again on the show. Laura, good to speak with you. Happy New Year. How are you?
Hi, Paul. Great to speak with you. Thanks. I'm doing well.
Great. And you took part in that, Laura, because you're the ranking member on the committee that would have some purvey on this, correct?
Well, actually, I was the ranking member. My colleague, Devin Kearney, currently, but I am a member of the committee, and I was part of the public hearing yesterday. Yeah.
Okay, so this would be, Laura, and obviously we all want our people that work construction zones and around school zones as well. We want these people to be safe. And sometimes, Laura, the only way to make people slow down is to hit them over the head with a fine, with a ticket. But explain what's being proposed here and maybe some of the positives or negatives that might be in this pilot program.
Sure. So there are these two provisions that are part of a far broader bill that really addresses aspects of pedestrian safety. And I think, you know, we've probably all experienced during COVID, you know, if people are out more walking outside or, you know, in the roads, that it is, and I experience it walking my two dogs, yeah, you know, cars just whipping by. We've had fatalities in our community. A woman out walking her dog was killed by a driver who was distracted. We also have had other, you know, serious accidents that have been really quite tragic. So I don't think that's unique here, but that was a broader context. There was probably over 70 pieces of testimony. A large part of it is from New Haven. That community has been pushing for a lot of these things for many years. But the two pieces that you were talking about do open the door for cameras, both in work zone areas, road, you know, work zones in limited access highways, and also what is new is for school zones. And why I say new is that work zone safety has come up over and over again in the legislature. And a good colleague of mine, Russ Morin, who did not run again and is not in the legislature, really worked hard to push this through. everybody supports greater safety for our people that are, you know, in DOT working or contractors working on our roads. And I'm sure we've all seen it too. People just flying by that put these guys at risk. So, but the issue of cameras have always stalled that. School zones are new, I believe. I don't recall that, certainly from last session, and I don't think before that. Mm-hmm. But there's probably more appetite to it, just given what people are seeing with COVID. And it seems like a lack of respect on the road across the board, right? I mean, cars flying by, people maybe not moving over, causing, you know, and bikers too. So here's the deal with both of these. They're similar. The work zone safety would, you know, go into effect across the board. Sure. The school zone piece would give the DOT and OPM the ability to work together to create a pilot for not more than 10 municipalities who could participate in this. Hmm. And that would be a pilot for 5 years. They would be operational after July 1st, 2022. In either case, the cameras are designed to snap just the license plate. So there's a concerted effort to not capture an image of somebody driving a car.
Sure.
But any tickets would go to the individual who is that vehicle is registered to, not necessarily whoever is operating that vehicle. In the case of work zone safety, you know, the state police would review the images, and within, I think it's 10 days, a citation would be sent to anyone who would have been driving 12 miles or over the speed limit.
Yeah.
For school zones, it's 11 miles. I'm not sure why we have that difference. The fines and work zone safety are increased from what exists. In the school zones, it would be $75 for a first time and $90 after that.
Now, Laura, there's a quote here. You may have seen it. It was on News 12's website. It's in some other spots. Andrew Matthews, the head of the state police union, doesn't like the bill. Let me give you the quote here in case you didn't see it or in case our listeners didn't hear it. He said, quote, "This bill proposes the use of speed cameras to replace state troopers on limited access highways, and it does not allow for the accused to have the right to cross-examine their accuser." And, you know, Laura, I took some calls earlier today promoting that you'd be on, and I had a bunch of people say, listen, if I'm speeding, that's fine. If you got me, you got me. I want to be able to talk to a cop. And I guess, Laura, we can all understand where the queasiness about this is. You know what I mean?
Sure. Sure. You know, the devil is always in the details, and there are always two perspectives, at least, on any of these things. And, you know, you hear a lot that, you know, maybe there may be a reason why somebody was driving faster than they should have been. Not that necessarily family. That is a good thing, but
family emergency or something.
Exactly. So to be able to have that conversation, it was interesting. Somebody had made a point in the public hearing yesterday that by not including police officers, that it would remove any potential bias of people getting tickets or not getting tickets. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, you know, I don't share a point of view on that, but I think that it's going to be an interesting debate, no doubt, because, you know, civil rights and civil liberties advocates have always fought hard against having this kind of technology. And we have equally as, you know, vocal advocates who do want to have it in place.
So give me your idea, Laura, of where does this go? Again, it's a very busy session. I know that. And sometimes these bills, they get introduced, they get tabled, they get pared down. What does your gut tell you about this, where we might see this going, running the session through April, May, or even June? What do you think?
So, as I mentioned, there are multiple provisions to this bill. And I think the majority of them would likely have strong bipartisan support. I don't think so. What has happened is yesterday was the public hearing. And what that does then is, you know, give a green light for the committee now to have a discussion. And then I would anticipate that the bill would get voted out of committee. and then would potentially come in front of the full legislature. It is an unusual session. We have some serious things to address, and not that this isn't, but if the if it is going to hold things up, there, you know, potentially would be parts of this removed or changed, or, you know, you don't, if it was going to really complicate things and aspects of the bill wouldn't move forward where there's strong agreement, you know, maybe certain pieces would get pulled out. But it's early, you know, to see. I think it does fit in terms of a COVID response, in terms of the number of people, again, who are, you know, out on our roads. And speeding is certainly an issue, and the safety certainly of our workers. So we'll see. Sure. It is going to move forward. There's going to be a lot of discussion. Mm-hmm. And I look forward to that to occur.
And Laura, finally, before I let you go, I just want to sneak one in here on you on the sports gambling. There's been a flurry of articles now, and you've obviously seen them, where, oh, my God, we're finally getting close, and the tribes and the governor and sports tech and everybody else saying it's really going to happen. We're excited. Is this just the gerbil wheel still turning again on this, Laura, or do you really think, is there a buzz that something may actually happen with legal sports gambling here this time around?
I know the governor has certainly expressed his interest in wanting that to move forward. I think the majority also is feeling that, you know, probably is something that they're going to want to do. So, again, you know, we'll see. It's been talked about a lot.
For 30 years.
It certainly was last session as well and didn't go anywhere.
Decades and decades, right? The land of steady habits,
yeah.
Right, Laura?
Yep.
Laura Devlin, Republican State Rep. Fairfield. Laura, thank you. We appreciate the time as always. Take care and we'll talk.
Thanks, Paul. Have a great night.
Appreciate it. Republican State Rep. Laura Devlin.